Okay, our final speaker is Guadalupe Pacheco. Okay, the title of his presentation is HHS, Office of Minority Health Enhanced National Class Standards, a blueprint for providing culturally and linguistically appropriate services to older adults.
Good afternoon. Buenas tardes. How are you? I know it's probably siesta time for some of you, so. But thank you very much for the introduction, and also great presentations by the previous colleagues that are doing some great work in the area of aging. First of all, I don't have any financial kind of disclosures to make because I work for the federal government. So, all right. So what I plan to do just quickly, the next 15 minutes or so, just talk about the Office of Minority Health, define what culturally and linguistically appropriate services, you know, class, what that means, and also valuing the culture of the aging or the grain of America, give you some demographics and why we think class is important in terms of service delivery for elderly Americans or elderly folks, right? I don't know if that's the correct term, but apologize if it's not. And talk a little bit about the draft National Class Standards Enhancement Initiative, some key components of the enhanced standards, and then present some resources. I'd just like to, before I get into my presentation, indicate that I have two individuals who are close to me. My mom, obviously, she's 84 years old. And so I'm going through that that process. I'm the oldest, by the way, of 11. So as the oldest of 11, I have to take a more leadership role in terms of her care. She recently broke her shoulder, so in the state of Seattle, as a matter of fact, Ellensburg. And so, you know, dealing with those kind of issues, because, you know, as folks age, you know, when they sustain injuries, it becomes harder in terms of the recovery process. And then you talk about depression, you know, those kind of variables start interplaying with that. And then you talk about medications, you know, pain medications, and all these kind of, they're all so interconnected. And then, you know, my mom was very independent, and now she's relying on somebody else to come in and take care of her. So it's like, you know, we've got to think about those kind of issues. Now, on the flip side, also, my mother-in-law, she's 90 years old. And she's also going through the dementia kind of process, plus all the medications that she's on. So it's you know, it's something that, you know, at least I am getting to that stage where I'm going to be confronting those issues myself. But I'm doing it now for my mother-in-law and for my mother. So it becomes more personal now, I think. So as I go through my presentation, I'll try to kind of link some of these personal kind of experiences that I'm having with my presentation. So the Office of Minority Health, what do? Well, we develop policies and initiatives that help eliminate or address health disparities that disproportionately affect minority populations, right? So, you know, African Americans, Latinos, Hispanics, you know, whatever you want to call yourself, Native Americans, Asian Pacific Islanders, et cetera. So that's our charge. In our office, you know, we really push for the delivery of culturally and linguistically appropriate services to diverse populations, simply because of changing demographics. So what are culturally and linguistically appropriate services? So, you know, everybody in this room, you know, interprets culture from their own kind of lens. They filter culture from their own kind of perspective. But I think it's important that we recognize that, you know, we do have some, I mean, people talk about differences. I look at them as assets, all right? And so, you know, take into account how we present our health issues to that clinical encounter, but also how clinicians interpret how we view health as an issue in terms of health beliefs, in terms of practices, in terms of health literacy issues. You know, just because I'm so-called educated, does that mean I understand all this medical terminology that's being presented to me during those clinical encounters? No, because you know, they're complex issues in the way clinicians talk to us. It's like, you know, I remember when I was growing up, sidetracked a little bit, there were three individuals that my grandparents would tell me not to question, right? Priests, teachers, and doctors. And doctors are like God. So, and then we talk about personalized health care, right? We're talking about patient-centered care. We've got to think about those kind of cultural, you know, issues that have been ingrained, you know, in us, you know, from the early ages, from, you know, when we were growing up. So, and then communication. I mean, you know, people talk about interpretation. Even though you introduce an interpreter to that clinical encounter, does that mean that that interpreter is qualified to be a medical interpreter? Does that mean that that individual has the skills to be a you know, an interpreter that can convey what the clinician is trying to interpret, or let's say make the diagnosis and then say, okay, this is the treatment, and then, you know, those kind of issues need to really be addressed. The bottom line is that, you know, as clinicians, we need to take all these kind of variables and issues into account when we start prescribing that kind of intervention for those individuals who are seeking our service. You know, valuing the culture of aging. You know, the aging, it's a different culture. You know, and just like, you know, we talk about organizational cultures, and all of us work in organizations that have different kind of cultures, you know, either in terms of promoting diversity, promoting excellence, you name it. But when you start going through that aging process, it's like, you know, you retire, and then do I get Social Security, Medicare, all these kind of variables, and then you talk about I was working, all of a sudden I'm no longer working, and then my kids are moving away, they're not calling enough. So all these kind of issues, you know, interplay with that whole aging process. So it's and how do we value, you know, our elders? I mean, I loved my grandparents because they raised me until I was about 5 and a half. And when my grandmother was about to die, my uncle called me and said, listen, your grandmother wants to see you. I said, yeah, you know, so I flew out to see her in Mexico. And she just wanted to see me and my relatives. And then I came back, and a week later, she was dead. She turned off the clock. I was like, whoa. She knew it was her time to go. You know, and it's amazing, you know, how, you know, elders can do that. You know, they can just say, I don't want to take any more medications. I want to stop the suffering. And boom, they turn it off. So we need, you know, I just love elders because they have so much to give, and we have so much to learn from them. So the growing diversity of older Americans. I mean, if you look at the 2010 census, and then you look at the projections in terms of 2050, 2010, I think there was about 20% of the aging populations were composed of minority groups. Right? Now look at 2050. It's almost 33%. Projections, and it's going to continue to grow. So as practitioners, we need to, you know, increase our ability to better serve this aging population, this diverse aging population. Okay, you know, communication. I mean, besides when you look at the let's say, language kind of issues, then you're also talking about what the loss of hearing, right, visual, cognitively even issues. So, you know, all those things, you know, are becoming more prevalent because of that whole aging process. So why are culturally and linguistically appropriate services important? Well, I think, you know, digressing a little bit, you look at the IOM study on, what is it, unequal treatment. You look at other studies, like from either the Joint Commission or the NCQA, the Quality Forum, you know, they all talk about the importance of providing, you know, culturally and linguistically appropriate services to diverse populations. Basically, you know, and the literature is starting to evolve in terms of showing the evidence that if you do provide class, right, that it does lead to better, let's say, trust a better trusting relationship with the patients. You know, the whole term about concordance is you have a practitioner who looks like the patient. You know that there's some commonality there, and that, you know, it does lead to better personalized care. It does improve adherence to treatment, and that, you know, the literature is starting to evolve. Not to say that all the evidence is there, but, you know, that it does increase patient satisfaction for those individuals who do receive a class. And the bottom line is that these are critical kind of elements or factors for advancing health equity, and that's a big term that's been used this through this whole conference. You know, class is part of health equity. You can't divorce, you know, class from health equity. And the bottom line for me is, and I think all of us, is that, you know, we need to look at class as one strategy to eliminate health disparities. It's not the panacea, but, you know, we talk about social determinants of health. You know, where you live does matter. And there are other kind of strategies that we need to use to help us eliminate health disparities. So we have their draft national standards for culturally and linguistically appropriate services in health care. We had the original iteration was in December of 2000. And there are 14, right now there's 14 standards, because the new ones have not been released. And so they're broken up with three themes: culturally competent care, language access services, organizational support. Right? And the new ones that were in the process, hopefully, of being released soon, are going to be titled the National Standards for Culturally and Linguistically Appropriate Services in Health Care. Okay? And the idea is that, you know, looking at advancing health equity and quality, you know, making sure that, you know, when we talk about class, we're also talking about quality. I mean, we want patients to receive quality health care. All right, that's the bottom line. And the idea when we release these standards is going to be a blueprint that's going to accompany these 15 standards, their draft, that in the blueprint is going to detail or give examples of how they can be implemented in various kind of settings. So if you work in the health, let's say in the aging arena, you can apply them to the aging arena. If you work in the mental health arena, you can apply and adapt them to those particular settings. So one key goal, if you look at the 2000 standards, standard goal was to decrease health care disparities and make practices more culturally and linguistically appropriate. The new goal, basically the driving principle of all the 15 standards, is to advance health equity, improve quality, and help eliminate health and healthcare disparities. The definition of culture, we expanded that. You know, before we just, you know, looked at, you know, racial and ethnic and linguistic groups. We want to, this time we said, hey, we got to make it more inclusive. All right, and so it, you know, addresses you know, geographic kind of areas, religion, spirituality, biological and sociological characteristics, et cetera, and down the line. So just example. Now, there's going to be 15 standards, and like I said, there's a principal standard that's going to be the overriding kind of theme that kind of, it's going to kind of reinforce all the standards, the 15 standards. There's the governance and leadership and workforce. Yeah, standard 3-4, and then the communication and language assistance, which is 5-8, and then engagement, continuous improvement, and accountability, 9-15. Governance, I should say, I got 2 minutes real quick. Governance, well, we, during our deliberations, we said, how are we going to make class part of the culture of the organization? It has to start from the top. It has to start from the board, and also from down to the CEO and president, and also from the bottom. So there's a convergence of the two. So again, governance, leadership, theme one, workforce, and this is theme two, looking at communication and language assistance. You know, language spoken, you know, induced interpretation, sign language, etc., written interpretation, translation of materials, multimedia, you know, the advancement because of social media and other applications. How do we use that to increase language access to diverse populations? Engagement, you know, how do we engage the consumers, the community in this whole process? The importance of continuous improvement, you know, striving to be better all the time. Accountability has to be, somebody has to be accountability as we infuse cultural competency into any type of organization. Now, this gives you just a snapshot in terms of from point A to point Z in terms of how we visualize or how we see cultural competency in every aspect of a client, a patient entering the healthcare system. Okay. And then real quickly, these are some resources that if you take anything away from my presentation today, take down this website. It's www.thinkculturalhealth.hhs.gov. Number of cultural competency e-learning programs, they're free. And this is a slide that gives you an idea of what I'm talking about. Physicians, nurses, emergency responders, and we're developing one on oral health. They're all fully accredited for CME and continuing education. And you know, if you complete the courses, you can get your certificate immediately. So there's some background information if you need anything else from me or the office. There's my contact information. Thank you so much.
When do you think the standards on health will be, the new ones will be actually?
I would say they're at the last stage of the review process, so hopefully either the middle of November or the first week in December.
By the end of this year?
Yeah, yes.
And how can one get a hold of them, find out, you know?
Right there. Yeah, go ahead, yes.
So I'm curious how the standards are enforced, if at all. I mean, are healthcare organizations, like, do they have to comply with these?
Well, a couple of things. When you your last comment about accreditation, the Joint Commission is really promoting CLASS, NCQA, the quality. All these accreditation bodies are promoting the concepts. The only ones I think that would have any teeth would be the ones that address communication assistance. All right. And again, it goes back to the original iteration of the CLASS standards that, you know, were language access services that were based on Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act as it applies to language minority populations. So if you're a federal entity, you get federal funds. You know, you have to make every effort to ensure language services to, let's say, limited English proficient individuals. The idea in terms of all the standards, they will have equal standing. So no longer is it just, well, some organizations only dealt with the language ones in the past. So the idea now is that all have equal standing. So in order to really be a culturally competent organization, you should strive to meet all the standards instead of just the language. Those are easy. Forget about the cultural competent, the culturally competent ones. No, it's everything now. I think, and we're not a regulatory body, so that's a big issue. But interesting, a lot of healthcare managed care organizations and like Kaiser Permanente, they're pushing this because of the changing demographics, and some of them see it as a new market, right? So, anybody else?
Okay, we have plenty of time for questions, so if anyone would like to direct a question to any of our speakers, please do.
Well, I'll start. It seems to me that hearing about all these prevention programs, procedures, makes me think that there should be some sort of survey that is throughout the population, senior citizens can go to. I guess daycare is there, daycare, but the number is quite small. Are there any examples of such programs there?
We have a volunteer answer.
There are lots of learning programs. I mean, there's senior centers, there's libraries, and so it'd be an issue like with the health literacy, let's say, and confidence to advocate and have programs that could be used in those various environments.
I think real quick, you have all these area aging kind of councils, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's a good vehicle to kind of promote this kind of, this kind of educational kind of activity. It's interesting that my 90-year-old mother-in-law, she reads constantly. So she's active in terms of making sure that she keeps her brain active, or her brain cells active. So I think that's important in terms of making sure that we keep the elderly population active and keeping them sharp as much as possible, because they have a lot to offer, and I think we just have to maximize those programs that are out there and leverage them to maybe push the levers and make something happen like that. It's almost like people talk about, you finish your degree. Yeah, but does that mean that I stop learning? So it's like a continuing education kind of process, so that we all keep learning and striving to be better, intellectually, I guess. So I think it's life learning. What is it? The life learning experience is that we need to push that. So.
But it's true that the two aspects of it, encouraging senior citizens, is to be physically active and to be socially engaged.
Does anyone have any comments about your question about the survey, surveying all seniors instead of just some?
Who's going to pay for it?
Is there an international set of health statistics? Is there like a survey of senior Americans? I mean, there are plenty of surveys about teenagers, about
Yes.
So I work for AIDS Healthcare Foundation. We have two plans for people with HIV, Medicare plan and a Medicaid plan. And so Medicare has an annual health outcomes survey it's a cohort study survey that asks questions on all dimensions of care for seniors. And Medicare, so you could maybe look at that.
Well, National Health Interview Survey, the MEPS, the Medical Expenditure Survey, which is linked, all do have that's in Medical Expenditures and Practices Survey.
Or I think it's panel.
Panel survey. Okay. They do have oversampling of certain groups, including minority groups, but maybe a lot of the questions we'd like to see asked are that.
And even with that oversampling, there still tends to be small samples for minority elders. And so that's also been a big topic of how to increase participation. So, and I know there's the, is it the NHANES for Hispanic Older Adults Longitudinal? So that one's been very successful, but it is focused on Hispanic elders.
Well,
yeah.
The key is, what is the highest age group? That's what I don't recall.
What is the highest age group that's in that survey? Oh, yeah, I'm not sure either, but I don't know. I mean, if they're focusing on older adults, I don't know why they would cut it off at a certain age. They might not do institutionalized adults, but I don't know. Does anyone know about that in terms of an age cutoff?
It may not cut off, but like with the NHIS, they report up to age 85, and then it's just 85 and over. So gerontological researchers, we'd like them to record all the way, but they don't.
Really? So they don't ask age in a continuous way? It's
well, yeah. They don't, but that's not how it's available. It's available 85 and over.
Oh, that's how they oh, wow.
There are problems with being identified.
Yeah, right.
So they have to do it in the aggregate.
I see. Wow.
Well, let me ask, in the federal government, where is the resource of the office which deals with aging Americans?
The Administration on Aging. Yeah, they're now part of the Administration on Community Living. That's the federal agency.
Is it a very major office?
Well, I mean, the issue with the Administration on Aging is we work with a lot of area agencies on aging referrals, that it's a fairly, the Administration on Aging funds something like 140 area agencies on aging around the country, and it's fairly decentralized. So one AAA may operate very differently than another. I mean, they have certain mandates by the feds, but it makes it challenging to implement something on a national scale unless the federal Administration on Aging says you all have to be doing this.
Like there's no cabinet.
They're at the secretary.
Yeah.
They're at the secretary, though.
They're like part of DHHS, right?
Yeah, they're assistant secretary for aging. There's an assistant
secretary.
Right.
Because she is appointed, Kathy
Greeley. But there are lots of issues, just, let's say the population knowing about things. And I had an example of being introduced to our organization, so both of the obvious, they look just there at that. So it was a senior center for Hispanic elders. And was located about four blocks from the AAA. Knew nothing about the AAA. Knew nothing about, as the great majority of senior centers around it, who are well connected and some getting funding, had no idea about, what's the AAA and what I'm going to do. I mean, that
very disturbing.
Lost opportunity.
Yes.
I just wanted to add to what Guadalupe said. Luis and I work with him on national class standards. And if you go to the Think Cultural Health website, there's a video page on class, and you can sign up or get an email and then you can state college. So you can be one of the first to know.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. Yes.
I was just going to say, actually, our organization does an annual culture and linguistic evaluation based on the class standards. Mm-hmm. And my colleague actually did a presentation yesterday on it. It's been really helpful using the class standards for the evaluation of our culture and linguistic program.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'd love to stay in touch as far as the new standards and how they, you and your organization help them come alive. And
we use them because a lot of our members are LGBT, so we really focus on that as a part of culture to enhance that part of provide training for our providers and all of our staff.
Okay. Also, Leslie asked about regulation or enforcement. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether there is such a requirement, but I work with the Department of Probation in Los Angeles, and we're required to have training in cultural conflict definition. Mm-hmm. So that's one way of
I mean, there is, for example, states that have passed legislation requiring practitioners to have X amount of CMEs. Mm-hmm. For example, state of New Jersey. Mm-hmm. If you want to practice as a physician in the state of New Jersey, you have to take X number of CMEs in cultural competence for licensure purposes.
I think one important thing is when you have a set of standards, those can then be used for regulation or organizational decision making, et cetera. So once they exist and once they're strengthened, then there can be laws. There can be accreditation decisions, and there can be organizational, like you say, Kaiser. You can use them then. If they otherwise, well, we don't have any standards, or we'd have to reinvent that wheel.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Any other comments or questions? Okay. Well, I'd like to thank all of our speakers and, of course, our audience. Thank you very much for attending.